At least 573 Palestinians have been killed and 2,470 others injured, many of whom are women and children.
Palestine. In every decade of the last 100 years, blood has been spilt on this tiny pocket of land in the Middle East. Ottoman Turks, French, Arabs, Jews have lost their lives here. Towns and villages have changed hands, been destroyed, rebuilt, and destroyed again. Guns and bombs from armaments factories in countries thousands of miles away have flowed here. The atom has been split here, and the only nuclear weapons in the Middle East are here. The President of Egypt, the Prime Minister of Israel, the leaders of the Palestine Liberation Organization and of Hamas have been assassinated because of events that took place here. Why? Tonight's timeline explains the roots of the conflict in Palestine. The great industrial powers are locked in mortal combat. Millions are dying in the trenches in Europe, but the consequences of the war are felt around the globe. The old semi-feudal Ottoman Turkish Empire, already shaken by nationalist revolution in 1908, is falling to pieces. And disastrously, it's allied to Germany. The British and French are out to make the most of the collapse of the Ottoman Empire in the Middle East, and the British are out to protect the routes to the jewel in the crown, the British Empire in India. The British will promise anything to anyone if they think it will help them win the war. In 1915, Sir Henry McMahon, the British High Commissioner in Cairo, wants to encourage an Arab revolt against the Ottoman Empire. He writes to Sharif Hussein, "As for the regions lying within the proposed frontiers, in which Great Britain is free to act without detriment to her ally, France, I am authorized to give you the following pledges on behalf of the government of Great Britain, and to reply to your note as follows. Great Britain is prepared to recognize and uphold the independence of the Arabs in all the regions lying within the frontiers proposed by the Sharif of Mecca." A year later, T. E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia, writes an intelligence note to his British commanders and encourages them to take the same course. He says it will be beneficial to us because it marches with our immediate aims: the breakup of the Islamic bloc, the defeat and disruption of the Ottoman Empire, and because the states that Sharif Hussein would set up to succeed the Turks would be harmless to ourselves. The Arabs are even less stable than the Turks, and if properly handled, they would remain in a state of political mosaic, a tissue of small, jealous principalities incapable of cohesion. Yet a year after this, Lord Arthur Balfour, the British Foreign Secretary, made an incompatible promise to a small group within the international Jewish community, the Zionists. His declaration of November 1917 read as follows: "His Majesty's government view with favour the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people." And he said that this should be with the understanding that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of the existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine. Two British promises about the same piece of land, self-determination for the Arabs and a homeland for the Jews. Both promises could not be kept, and it was the Balfour Declaration that was written into the treaties that ended the First World War. But treaties are just pieces of paper. Facts on the ground are a different thing. The British occupied Palestine in 1917 and after 1920 still ran Palestine under a mandate from the League of Nations. Neither the indigenous Arabs or Jews, who had lived in Palestine side by side for centuries, were granted any political rights. But the mandate did insist that the British must safeguard the interests of the Jewish settlers. By placing the country under such political, administrative, and economic conditions as will secure the establishment of a Jewish national home. Under British rule, Zionist immigration into Palestine rose to unprecedented levels. In 1930, just 4,000 Jewish settlers arrived, but by 1933, that figure had climbed to 30,000 Jewish settlers, and in the peak year of 1935, 60,000 Zionist settlers arrived in Palestine. Palestinian land was being bought up by settlers, often from absentee landlords. Society in Palestine was being thrown into the air in a way that had never happened in generations of Ottoman rule. Palestinians resisted. In 1921, in 1922, in 1929, and most of all, after the general strike of 1936, the British were unable to control the revolt. And neither could the British control the Zionists. Led by future Israeli leaders David Ben-Gurion, Yitzhak Shamir, and Menachem Begin, they organized into militia and terrorist gangs like the Haganah, the Agun, and the Stern Gang. The Zionists aimed to drive the British out and to take control of Palestine. The First World War gave the Zionist project its start, and the Second World War gave the project its chance of victory. Britain was among the victors of the Second World War, but in 1945, Britain was an exhausted country, no longer able to shoulder the demands of empire. The Labour Party was elected by a landslide in the 1945 election, and it reflected the massive popular reaction against war and empire. Britain began the long retreat from empire, and India, Burma, and Palestine were the first to see the British depart. Palestine was in any case ungovernable for the British by this time, a fact forcefully brought home to the Mandate government when the Zionist Irgun blew up its headquarters at the King David Hotel in Jerusalem in July 1946. Less than 2 years later, the British were out, and the newly formed United Nations were left in charge of Palestine. The UN enforced the partition of Palestine. Under its plan, the Zionists, who up until this point had purchased only 6% of Palestinian land, were granted control of 55% of Palestine. Towns and villages, factories and farms that had been Palestinian for time out of mind were handed over to the settlers. But the Zionists seized the moment and extended their gains even further by a campaign of terror against the Palestinian population. Armed militia and terror gangs swept through the Palestinian towns and villages, shooting and bombing as they went. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were driven from their homes. As the British left, the Zionists declared their own state, the State of Israel. The Palestinians and their Arab neighbours rejected this unilateral breach of the United Nations plan. A short war ensued, but the disunited Arabs and virtually unarmed Palestinians were now no match for the highly militarised settlers. By the end of the conflict in 1949, Israel had taken more land, and hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were exiled to the Egyptian-controlled Gaza Strip, Jordanian-controlled East Jerusalem and the West Bank, and to Jordan itself, Syria, Egypt, and Lebanon. The State of Israel was born of terror, war, conquest, and dispossession. How could this ruthless expropriation of an entire people happen? What made it possible? Two things made the founding of the State of Israel possible. One was the support enjoyed by the Zionists from the major powers. First Britain, then the League of Nations acting through Britain, then the United Nations, and latterly the United States. Without this, the tiny band of Zionists, still a minority current within their own community, could not possibly have established a foothold in Palestine. The second was the impact of the Holocaust. The industrial extermination of European Jewry by Hitler and the Nazis was only becoming fully known at the time that the Zionists were expropriating the Palestinians. The overwhelming horror of the Holocaust made many more Jews sympathetic to the Zionists, though still most wanted to go to America or Europe rather than to Israel. But the suffering of the Jews also made non-Jews sympathetic to the Zionists, and they did not always stop to reflect on whether the Zionists actually represented what most Jews thought. Yet the truth is that the establishment of the State of Israel deepened the tragedy of the Jewish people. It has allowed the horror of the Holocaust to be used by the Zionists as an excuse for the dispossession of the Palestinians. Thus, one tragedy is used to justify a second, one great crime used to hide another. The state born at war in 1948 has been at war in every decade of its existence. In 1956, Israel assisted Britain in its ill-fated attempt to take back the Suez Canal when it was nationalized by Egyptian leader Gamal Abdel Nasser. In 1967, Israel massively expanded its territory in a war with Jordan, Syria, and Egypt. In 1973, another Arab-Israeli war partially reversed the Arab defeat of 1967. In 1982, Israel invaded and occupied southern Lebanon. Israel remained in occupation of southern Lebanon throughout the 1990s and only withdrew in the year 2000. In 2006, Israel again invaded Lebanon, but it was forced to withdraw in the face of Lebanese resistance. Yet this remarkably war-dependent state is actually very small. Israel has a population slightly smaller than London. So how does this tiny state survive? The truth is that it cannot survive simply from its own economic and military resources. It is wholly dependent on the aid that it receives from the Western powers, especially from the United States. Consider the facts. Israel is the biggest recipient of US military aid in the world. It is also the biggest recipient of US civilian aid in the world. It receives over half of the US aid budget, with only 1/1000th of the world's population. Israel is the only country in the world that can use US aid to buy non-US produce. Israel is the only country in the world that can buy non-US armaments with US military aid. Israel is the only country in the world that can buy weapons directly from US arms companies without the purchases having first to be vetted by the US Department of Defense. Israel, not Iran, is the only nuclear power in the Middle East. And Israel has broken more UN resolutions than any other country in the region, including Saddam Hussein's Iraq. But what does the US get for its money and patronage? It does not do this simply to assist Israel in its conflict with the Palestinians. It does not do it because the economic resources of Palestine, the oranges and the olive oil, are vital to it economically. What the US needs from Israel is the strategic force that can police the whole Middle East. It is this whole area that is both strategically and economically essential to US interests. But this task cannot be achieved simply by supporting Israel alone. To exercise effective influence over the whole Middle East, the US and its allies must both support Israel and neutralize the Arab struggle for self-determination. Thus, although Israel is the biggest recipient of US military aid, Egypt is the second biggest recipient, and Jordan the third biggest recipient. In the imperial architecture of the Middle East, Israel is paid to hold down the Arabs, and Egypt and Jordan are paid not to attack Israel. It is this wider reality that has always given the Palestinian cause such great resonance in the whole Middle East. And it is also why many Arab rulers find the Palestinians who live among them a disquieting presence, so disquieting that they have on occasion attacked the Palestinians themselves. This is what happened in Black September 1970, when the Jordanian army attacked the Palestinians. It is what happened when President Anwar Sadat of Egypt came to a separate peace with Israel, a deal which cost him his life when he was assassinated in 1981 by a military officer who shouted death to the Pharaoh as he shot Sadat during a military parade in Cairo. The same policy is still being pursued by Egypt's current president, Hosni Mubarak. During the Gaza protest, Mubarak had the power to open the Rafah crossing between Gaza and Egypt. Had he done so, the Palestinians would have a route to safety, and the effect of the Israeli attack would have been blunted. But Mubarak refused to act, leaving the Palestinians trapped in Gaza. This logic of incorporation has served the US well with the Arab governments, and they have now the same approach to the Palestinian leadership themselves, with the creation of the Palestinian Authority. But the Arab governments are at least in control of their own state, and they are secure behind their own borders. The Palestinians are not. And so the artificial state of the Palestinian Authority cannot either defend the Palestinians from the Israelis or control the anger of the Palestinian Intifada. This leaves the Palestinians and those who want economic and justice and democracy in the whole of the Middle East as natural allies. It is why the common struggle for economic equality and democracy tends to draw together the people of the Middle East, even when their rulers do not represent their aspirations. Yet it is the realization of those aspirations that the only real lasting peace in the Middle East can be found. Israel was established as a state by colonial settlement just at the time when the major powers were carving out the modern Middle East from the remnants of the Ottoman Empire. The indigenous people were displaced and dispersed by the settlers. The regime that the Zionist settlers established has been sustained by the support of the major powers, especially the United States, ever since. Israel enjoys this unprecedented support because it is the defender of US strategic interests in the whole Middle East, not simply or even mainly because the US supports Israel in its conflict with the Palestinians, although it must do this if Israel is to survive. And just as the survival of Israel is linked to the wider politics of the Middle East, so too are the hopes and aspirations of the Palestinians. Parallels are often drawn today between the Israeli state and the apartheid South Africa of the 1970s and 1980s. And it is indeed true that Israel treats the Palestinians as the white supremacists once treated the black population of South Africa. But there is also a vital difference. The mainspring of black liberation was the enormously powerful black working class of South Africa itself. The Palestinians themselves do not have the same weight inside Israel as the black working class had in South Africa. But the Arab masses of the whole Middle East have an even greater power than did the black masses of South Africa. It will be this wider conflict, the conflict between Israel, the US and its allies on the one side, and the Palestinians and their masses of the Middle East on the other, that will finally decide whether peace and justice can triumph in Palestine and in the Middle East.